Okay, good evening, everyone. This is Rochelle Wilhite, the designated broker for Best Choice Realty. We are going to be discussing some of the contract bloopers that I'm seeing and answer some questions, specific questions related around the contract. Not so much in Form 21. I'm seeing some better preparation and filling those out correctly on Form 21, 28, and the regular purchase and sale agreement, but really the addenda, some of the addenda that the agents are forgetting to use, or they're just not checking the appropriate boxes. So hopefully you have a Form 22A, a 22D, and a 22EF, perhaps printed out or looking at that on your Northwest MLS forms. So those are the addenda we're going to talk about tonight. Just housekeeping, we're going to keep it brief tonight. We'll be done by 6 o'clock. And if you have any questions related around a specific issue, you're welcome to email me. My email address is Rochelle, R-A-C-H-E-L-L-E, at bestchoicerealtywa.com. Or you could text me if there's a specific easy question that you have a question about, and I'll get back to you quickly. So if we go to the 22A, this is the most misunderstood addenda, I think, out of all of the contracts that we use on a regular basis. So I want to make it very clear on what the 22A is and what kind of contingency this would be if you were to place it in an offer. In some of the areas where we service, I am seeing, in order to get an offer accepted, the buyer is even having to waive the financing contingency. So I want you to understand what this financing contingency is from the perspective of the seller and what it means to the buyer if they have a finance contingency in place. And some of the key things to keep in mind when explaining this financing contingency to your buyer. In the world of fast real estate and when it's fast moving, I'm hearing people, oh, I'll send this to you electronically to sign. You know, your due diligence as the agent is to explain when asked questions about the 22A. And so I want to make it very clear on what you should keep in mind when discussing with the potential buyer what they should consider when looking at this contingency. So number one, you need to consider if they're going to get a loan and they are wanting a way out of the contract, that's when you would use a 22A. If the buyer says, Rochelle, I'm underwritten, we haven't been able to secure two or three other homes, we're up against a cash offer, maybe the only way for us to get the house over a cash buyer would be to waive the financing contingency altogether. If you're in that kind of category, I want to speak with you before you decide not to use a 22A when getting financing. The lender has to be on board with certain things. The seller has to allow you access to the property for an appraisal. And there are some other provisions we'll need to write in order for the waiver to take place. So if you are getting financing and you're wanting to waive the financing contingency, you just need to talk to me and I'll help you create that addendum or, in essence, allow for the appraisal, and there's other provisions we need to keep in mind, but then competing with that other cash buyer. So having said that, let's just say for the interest of time and going over this tonight, 90% of the buyers are going to need financing, and you will be using a 22A to get to submit with your offer. So as written in Term 1A, you do need to check the appropriate box. Are they getting conventional financing? Are they getting a bridge loan? Are they getting VA or FHA? Or is it a USDA out in the outlying areas, a farm loan? Or is it some sort of other financing? Maybe it's a hard money loan. Maybe it's some sort of other type of financing. Maybe it's a Washington State Housing Finance Commission loan where there's a down payment assistance program available for this buyer as well. Any type of information that the lender will give you in accordance with their loan should be documented here in 1A. So, for example, what could be debated is, did you do a good job in understanding how your buyer is financing? Was there a conversation with the lender in understanding how to write this contract? And if we find out that there was a breach by the buyer or by the seller and we're discussing earnest money being released to either or both parties, the first thing they're going to look at is how was the loan application taken and how was the contract written by the buyer's agent and what was disclosed to the seller. And if you had made an error here, maybe, for example, the conventional, but then they actually were getting FHA, and that's the way the pre-approval letter was sent over, then there's a discrepancy there. And that would fall on your shoulders, and there could be some conflict that we'd have to overcome if it wasn't written correctly in 1A. So it really behooves you to work with the lender to find out what type of financing your borrower or the buyer is getting and make sure it's properly disclosed here to the seller in writing. That includes filling out the second box, which it says buyer shall pay either an amount or 3.5% down or 5% down. Again, it's going to depend on the type of financing, but you want to put in the number there. You want to do the minimum. Now, certainly, if you're going to be putting 50% down, that's going to be much different. The buyer or the seller is going to like that more than money down. Obviously, that's going to give them more security. But you do want to make sure that you're disclosing properly where those funds are coming from. So you need to have that conversation with the buyer, you know, where is the down payment coming from? Is the down payment coming from the sale of a property? Is it a gift from mom and dad? Have you discussed that with the buyer so you know where that down payment is coming from? That would be best practice. It's not your responsibility to be the lender, but it is good to understand where that down payment is coming from to avoid a counteroffer or the funds not being readily available, and then we have to fight for your earnest money down the road. The other part here, if not filled in, is 5 days. So what that means is that the buyer can shop the loan within that period of time. I use that as when somebody's asking, what does that application part mean? That means that you have the right, you know, you are welcome to go with BECU, that's who you've applied with already, to get pre-approved, but this part in term 1A allows us to shop the loan and make application and decide on who we're going to go with in terms of the loan. If we don't fill it in, it says we have 5 days to shop. So I would call it our shopping clause, allowing us to shop the loan and get you the best deal possible. If you have somebody that you've never worked with before, maybe it's a lender, like, for example, Bank of America has not had such a good reputation. Some of the lenders are getting better. But let's say they are pre-approved with Bank of America and you want to have a second opinion on the loan, you may want to advise during this period of 1A that they do a double application, meaning they apply with Bank of America, but then they also apply with Greystone Mortgage and have a second opinion. Greystone might be able to get them a better deal and therefore save them money. What needs to happen during that first 5 days, though, is that whatever pre-approval letter or whatever lender you guys are going to be using, that lender letter, best practice would be to send that to the listing agent and say, here is who they've made final application with, and this is the lender we're going to be using, and give them a copy of the updated pre-approval letter within that 5-day period of time. In 1B, if the buyer does not make application within that 5 days or changes the loan type, maybe they go from being conventional to FHA, or they change the type of lender, maybe they had told the seller all along they were using Bank of America, and then after 5 days they change their mind and decide to go with a different lender, again, without the prior written consent of the seller, there's a form for that, then they've waived their financing contingency. So that's a very important point. If you're going to highlight anything on this entire contingency, if you're representing a buyer, you got to read 1B. That whole section is very important, and it's lost a lot of buyer's agents' clients' earnest money over the years just because they don't understand that what happens to waive their financing contingency automatically. That's without question. And I fought hard for some of our sellers' earnest money, and that's the number one thing we're going to try to go after, is did they make application appropriately? Did they change their loan type or the lender? And if they did without our prior consent, automatic waiver of financing contingency. And none of the rest of this form is important. Earnest money would be refunded to the seller. Okay? So that's really the only play where some buyer's agents make mistakes. Number two and number three, these are, if not filled in, are 10 days, 3 days, and 30 days. And all of this is in the best interest of the buyer, more so than the seller. And here's why. if you fill in the regular time, if you want to cut it down, it doesn't really matter. If you read what is written in 3A, it says, at any time 30 days is not filled in, the seller may give notice that the seller may terminate the agreement at any time 3 days after delivery of the notice using the 22AR. So what that means is that the seller would have to give you notice if you didn't waive your financing contingency automatically because of failing to do something, and your contingency continued through the life of the escrow. In essence, your buyer's earnest money is very much protected during the entire duration of this contingency. However, if they send you over a 22AR, they should also send it to me, and that would give you 3 days to either waive your financing contingency and move towards closing, or to elect to terminate the agreement and get your earnest money back. So it does give you, puts you on notice. Very rarely do I see a listing agent do a good job here and send you over a 22AR upon that 3A section in the contract. Many listing agents fail to execute the 3A. I'd say 95% fail to execute the 3A termination. So if the buyer has not previously waived the financing contingency or filled out the 22AR, and there's nothing has been sent over the 22AR, read 3B, the last sentence. If not waived, the financing contingency shall survive the closing date. That means that if there has not been any waiver for financing, the buyer will be entitled to their earnest money because the seller or the listing firm has not asked for a waiver to take place. The financing contingency protects your buyer's earnest money. So you, as long as, again, there's some other terms that are discussed later, which means that the funds have got to be valid and the lender would have to provide a letter of loan denial and some other things that would also be important to know. But in essence, this financing contingency is definitely more in the favor of the buyer, and it protects the earnest money. So if you do need to cut timelines down in order for you to get the file or to make the lender work faster or harder or put them on notice that things need to get done a little bit quicker, make sure that they're aware that we have a right to terminate. And I have seen people start to cut those down from 30 days to 21 days. I've seen one even at 15 or 10 days. That means that they could terminate the contract or give you the right to continue on or waive your financing contingency after that period of time. So those are the misunderstood timelines. And I think the number one thing that a lot of people don't realize, listing agents specifically, is that 3B, if they do not execute their rights with a 22AR notice, in essence, the financing contingency will last the entire life of the escrow. And there's a risk that the buyer could just walk away even the day before closing and then get their earnest money back. And too bad, so sad for the seller, because they are going to keep that contingency in place. That would be a place that if I was representing the seller, I would want to counter to keep the buyer's agent and the buyer's lender on track. Number four, loan cost provisions. That's where you need to write in closing costs. I'm seeing more people write in a percentage rather than the dollar amount, and that's, again, for negotiation purposes. It would be off the purchase price. You would need to talk with the lender and find out, but I'm seeing a lot more people using the percentage rather than the dollar amount because the seller would have to calculate that, and it doesn't seem as bad when negotiating closing costs. So if you're in an area of the state where there is negotiation taking place on closing costs, you may want to consider how you write that up. You may want to do it as a percentage rather than a dollar amount just because you may get more in negotiations. And then I think the appraisal less than the sales price, I want to discuss number seven with you guys as well. If number seven comes up, if the lender, back up a little bit here. No, let's see. Back up. Appraisal less than the sales price. 3C, also very, very much misinterpreted, and it takes kind of a law degree to understand what 3C is all about. But appraisal less than the sales price, if you do not check the box, that is more in the buyer's favor. If you check the other box, the default, The default is more in the buyer's favor. The other one is in the seller's favor. So we want to have will, if not filled in. That is for the buyers. Will not would be more in the favor of the seller. So if it's will, then what will take place is 7A, B, and C if the appraisal does not come in at value. So in essence, you have an appraisal contingency that also rides along, that's a big kind of a rider, along with the financing contingency. So it also protects the buyer's interest and allows for negotiation if the appraisal does not come in at the value. If you have checked the other box, which is will not, then what that means is that your contingency, your financing contingency, is not, doesn't ride along with the appraisal less than the sales price. So that would be in a multiple offer situation where you want to maybe switch that. However, you've got to make sure that the buyers have the additional funds that might be necessary to come in to close if the appraisal does not come in at the sales price. If you leave it as a default, terms 7, A, B, and C would stay in the contract. So what that means is you would have the ability to negotiate if the appraisal did not come in at value. Okay? That's the way I would explain it to a buyer as well. Very simply, and again, they can read it, but in essence, that's the way that it would play out. If you have a situation where the appraisal does not come in at value and you need my help, they're required to send a copy of the appraisal along with the 22AN notice, and we would get a copy of that, and I could help you through what are the process. But it's really very simple. If you read B, it talks about the options that the seller has to deal with and then how the buyer would respond. So if you get an appraisal that does not come in at value, what that usually means is you're looking at an extension of at least 10 to 15 days while we deal with that contingency satisfaction of the appraisal coming in less than the sales price. And it doesn't always bode well. Sometimes it works for the buyer, sometimes it doesn't. And it's kind of an unfortunate situation when that happens with 7, A, B, and C. In the long run, buyers sometimes get money off, but sellers have to reduce the price, and again, it's renegotiated. So it just gets muddier as we go along when you have something like that occur. Okay, the next form we're going to go to, so we have some time to cover it, would be 22D, D as in dad. That is the optional clauses, and I request all of our contracts, no matter if it's vacant land or if it's a residential or a condo, I like to see a 22D because there's some additional protection, not only for the buyers but also for the sellers and for you as agents, even just if we check box number one. Optional clauses means that we are covering ourselves, that things that are optional that are not covered in the regular purchase and sale agreement. So square footage, lot size, encroachments, things like that, it puts the buyer and seller on notice by checking box number one that they are to advise and to verify to their own satisfaction during the inspection period. So I like to always check box number one, and that's the main reason why we use 22D, is for some protection there. There's been quite a few legal disputes and lawsuits that have occurred, not with our firm, but with other firms I've managed, and it all had to do because the broker who was running the company at that time did not require a 22D, and so then they had some issues down the road. So always make sure you include a 22D whenever you're working with a residential, condo, multifamily, or even land purchase, because it talks about the lot size and encroachments. Also, it talks about in term two on 22D, the title insurance clause that protects that the seller will provide. Now, in term two, this is often misunderstood because they changed this back about a year ago, a couple years ago, they changed it so that you don't check a box if you want the good policy. And what I mean by the good policy would be the ALSA policy. It has the best coverage when you look at the checkbox of what a standard title policy covers for a buyer and a seller, and then a ALSA policy. ALSA has the additional benefits. And so you're going to want to make sure that you don't check the box and opt for the standard or the lower coverage, that you keep the ALSA policy in place. By including the 22D, term two would be in place, and the escrow and the title company would be making sure that your buyer or seller ordered an ALTA policy rather than a standard policy. Now, times where this would not take place, or where you might get a counteroffer and you're like, what is this about? Short sales often will have an opt clause that will opt them out, and they will not be providing an ALTA. They'll probably be providing the standard. So even though you may choose to include number two, the parties will probably have the option for the buyer to pay the additional coverage if they want an ALTA policy, but that will be at the buyer's cost rather than the seller's cost on a short sale. Other times, foreclosures will also have some sort of language that would override term two that you need to be aware of, and also new construction will have language that will negate or modify term two that you have written here. So all in all, best rule of thumb would be to include the 22D and to let them counter if they need to, and then explain it to your buyer if they come back and counter you. But I don't want you guys to opt for the lower coverage when you're representing the buyer. I'd want you to include the ALTA policy as much as possible. Term three, I always check that box. This allows the buyer and seller to agree that if there's an appliance, gives us the right to reinspect, to make sure the appliances are working, that things are operative. For example, I had one deal where inspection went fine. The seller agreed to fix all the repairs, and then we did a final walkthrough. It was an older home, and we knew that the garage door opener was kind of on its last leg. And, you know, even at the inspection, we didn't ask for it because we thought, you know, it will probably be okay. But here we go. We do a 5-day walkthrough, and that garage door opener just did not work. It was totally dead, and it was 5 days prior to closing. So what we did is we exercised our right on term 22D, term three. We reserved our right to reinspect the property. We just walked through the property real quick after the sellers had moved out, checked all of the functions, and they'd served the stove and the toilet flushed, and we just walked through to make sure the electrical was all in place and everything was intact. And then we opened the garage door, and that's when we saw the garage door did not function. So since the garage door didn't function, we called the listing firm. The listing firm went right out there because they didn't want to hold up closing. They replaced the garage door opener with a new system, and it had to be at least equal quality. So they actually just went to Home Depot and got a new garage door opener and installed it prior to closing. So if we hadn't checked the box in term three, and we wouldn't have done a walkthrough, but it allows us to do a walkthrough real quick, and then we would not have got that garage door opener. So it saved my clients a few $100. They were super happy because they didn't have to worry about that after moving in. That's an example of term three of why it's important. Doesn't mean that they can go and reinspect and find things wrong. That's for the inspection period. This is, again, if the system or appliance is not malfunctioned or it malfunctions or becomes inoperative, then it allows us to work with the seller on that. Term four, I also like to include term four, even in short sales, because it basically puts the listing firm on notice that the buyer is not going to, you know, the buyer wants it free of rubbish, trash, prior to taking possession. So if there's a house that has a lot, it's a hoarder house, you know what I'm talking about, that has all these boxes and all these things, you don't want to have a trash dump run that you have to do or pay for. In that case, you'd want to make sure you check box four so that the property, any personal property, remains on the property. Maybe they leave the extra freezer out in the garage that's functioning. That would be fine. But if the other refrigerator they have out in the garage is malfunctioning and does not work and it's garbage, we don't want to have to deal with that trash upon, you know, taking possession. So it needs to be in the contract, and the way you hold this accountable is when you check box three and box four, do a walkthrough, and something doesn't seem right, pictures remain in the property or garbage, it's before closing that we can address and enforce term three and term four. If you didn't check box three and four, we would not get the opportunity to do a walkthrough. We wouldn't know if there was trash or debris, and we would not be able to hold the listing firm accountable to box three and four if we close the deal and then we want something done. So make sure you understand what three and four say Box 5, I always want to make sure you guys are checking the appropriate boxes there. We have had certain circumstances in the past where the seller in this contract says that it's a sewer main and represents it as a sewer, but then we find out later on that it was actually on a septic. So in essence, they breached, and that becomes a little problematic where we actually have to deal with that legally. So always make sure that you have the proper utilities checked here. If there is gas or if there is electricity, make sure you indicate that. And then to the seller's knowledge, the seller represents that the property is connected to those items. Number 6 is usually not checked because it's usually in the builder's contract. And number 7 is not always, there's not always leased property. It's very rare that there is, but if there is, that would need to be disclosed. And number 8 would be a way to back out using a homeowners association contingency. So I'm not seeing a lot of that because of multiple offers going on, but that is a way to back out if it's subject to review of homeowners association. Number 9, that's where the seller would probably counter if there was a chandelier or some draperies that they wanted. I see a lot of that happens. But number 10, I want you to, at best choice, to check box number 10, and you should give them advice on home warranty plans that would be available to them. And if they choose to have no home warranty, you would, in term 10D, in the other section, write, buyer chooses no home warranty. That way it's very clear that you've offered them some home warranties, you've shared with them what the pricing would be for a 1-year home warranty, and they've chosen not to opt for a home warranty. That takes a lot of the stress and pressure off people calling you after the fact when the deal closes saying, uh-oh, my dishwasher went out on me, or uh-oh, I'm having a little toilet leak. Those types of questions actually don't come to me as much because our agents are doing a better job at educating the buyers on what a home warranty would cost and what it would entail, and that they can put that in place and save sometimes thousands of dollars. I had a short sale one of my buyers did, and we ended up doing I paid for a home warranty for them. In fact, the listing agent and I shared the cost of a home warranty, and I think at the end of the year, we totaled up how many repairs, the company came out to fix for this particular property, and they got a new dishwasher, they had the refrigerator fixed, and they had 2 plumbing leaks that were addressed with the home warranty. So in essence, it was like, I think, the $1,400. The home warranty plan cost the agent and I, we split it $350, so I had to pay $125. I've been a client for life. So something like that where the property warrants a home warranty and you've educated the buyer on why to get a home warranty, that was a great option for us to go with on that particular property. So again, you could put the home warranty and then you could in the other section, buyer's agent to pay for home warranty at closing. You can help give that to them as a gift. I have had agents do that before. But it should be discussed no matter what. So box number 10, like to have you guys always check the box. And at least the minimum on the other, buyer chooses no home warranty, or if it's being negotiated, we indicate who the home warranty provider is and roughly how much. I go up to $400, and my favorites are Old Republic and Fidelity are my 2 favorites for home warranty plans. And the options to be included, make sure you always include the water heater and the furnace in the options to be included, as well as the washer, dryer, and refrigerator. Okay. Just a brief mention on 22T. 22T is a title contingency. If you're using cash and you're wanting a way to back out on something, there isn't a way or a contingency to back out and get your client's earnest money, you may want to include a 22T. However, it is a way for your buyer to back out and the seller to say, we'll go with the other offer. So just realize that 22T is in TOM. That would be an additional contingency. It rides right along with the Form 35 or inspection contingency. So if you are getting an inspection contingency and you have that right to back out during that time, this 22T is an additional way that you could back out. So the time I recommend these are when there is some sort of challenge on the title. You're not quite sure if there's a divorce or if the prelim is not uploaded or you don't have a good legal description. You may want to include a 22T. However, just realize that if you have a Form 35, we do have the same way to back out on the Form 35 if something doesn't seem right with the property. So it's a double contingency in a way if you use an inspection contingency. The last form I'll go over briefly is a 22EF. I'm seeing that come up more and more because listing agents are getting frustrated. They are getting multiple offers on their listings, and then I'm starting to see properties come back on the market. Buyers' financing failed. Buyers walked away at the last minute. This is where listings agents get frustrated and sellers are requesting. In fact, there was a property I was showing tonight, and it says 22EF on file. So in essence, buyers had already fallen through. The sellers were unhappy. They wanted to make sure that they understood where the funds were coming from. When I talked with the listing agent about this property and why she was using a 22EF as a supplementary document and a required addenda that she's asking the new buyer's agents to fill out, she wants to have the right for her seller to verify the proof of funds and to see where those funds are coming from. So even a cash buyer, you could throw in a 22EF and give that seller assurance that you are, in essence, good for the money, where the source of funds were coming from. In her case, the buyers got their earnest money back because the seller did not verify the funds, and it was all up to closing, and they never came through with the funds, and so they actually got their earnest money back, and it was very frustrating. So with the 22EF, it does say that the funds must be at escrow 10 days prior to closing, that you have to provide proof of where the funds are going to come from, either a bank statement or some sort of retirement account or whatever it's coming from. And then in term two, it talks about where the source. If you were getting money from, say, Hong Kong Bank, you would want to put the Hong Kong Bank on term two. And just make sure, though, if you're using 22EF, that the funds are available and liquid in the escrow's account according to term three, which it says, if not filled in, 10 days prior to closing. So if you need to shorten that down, that would probably be best, maybe 5 days. That would be, especially if it's cash. You know, sometimes you have to wait for the funds to get from China to the United States and then from the United States into escrow. There's a delay that takes place when that happens. So make sure you've gone over that with your client, with your buyer, to make sure they understand when those monies would need to be in escrow. And if you have questions about how to use the 22EF, if you're a seller or if you're working with a buyer who's paying cash, I like to see a 22EF because it puts everybody on notice on where the funds are coming from and when the funds are going to be delivered so that we can close on time. So I'm a big proponent of using a 22EF. Even if you're not sure and you're a listing agent and you've got a 40% down buyer, and you're not quite sure where that 40% is coming from, you think maybe some of it's coming from the proceeds of a sale, maybe some of it's coming from the gift from mom and dad, you may want to counter your buyers, if you're a listing agent, with the 22EF form and then make sure that they fill it out so that you know where the funds are coming from and you can confirm that this is a good, solid buyer. That's the only way you can protect your seller's interest and the time on market. Because as you may or may not know, if you've done a lot of deals, it is extremely frustrating when you put in a lot of time and effort in marketing the property, listing the property, time off the market, multiple offers, going through several offers sometimes, to have that buyer that you chose walk away or not have the funds available. It's extremely frustrating and you lose a lot of momentum. So you want to do everything you can as a listing agent to tighten up your offers, make sure your buyers are complying with some of the tightenings, and also funds verifications also very important. Don't feel bad about calling that pre-approval letter if you're a listing agent and making sure that the lender has indeed talked with the agent and the buyer and has got their updated bank statements and things like that and they're solid. If you call that lender the pre-approval and they're like, I don't even know who this person is, you've got a pre-approval letter that's not even valid. So, again, bring me into the loop if you have certain questions or concerns about some of your deals you're working on. But in essence, we covered the important things tonight about what to consider in 22A, 22D, and 22EF. And also, don't forget to attach your legal descriptions to your offers. And I think best practice to have them initialed as well so that all parties know that that is part of the contract, the legal description that's attached to the listing. have a great week, you guys. Hopefully you guys can jump on Wednesday night. It'll be our first call. It is going to be streamed, and it's going to be on webinar format, so you can see the listings on the computer. So if you happen to be by your computer on Wednesday night, it'll just be a 30-minute conference call on listings, and I'll do that once a month. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you guys soon.